Good morning, Boker Tov. Welcome back to Parsha Perspectives for today. So good to be together and learning Sefer Shmos, Parsha Shmos, page 292 in the Art Scroll Stone Chumash. And we are going from our first family, the book of Bereishis. When the curtain comes down, we are a family that have hopefully learned how to reconcile differences, reunite, and hopefully the curtain comes down on a Klal Yisrael, a B'nai Yisrael, who are able to function as a family, albeit a continuing imperfect one. And the curtain comes up on Sefer Shmos, and now we are forming a nation. Our Parsha series is generously sponsored by Becky and Avi Katz and family in loving memory of Becky's father, David ben Menachem Manash, David Grossman. This morning's shir is dedicated anonymously to the Refuah Shlema of Rav Natanel ben Miral, by Marilyn Stein in memory of Rabbi Dr. Steven Stein, Shimon Feivish ben Yisrael Yitzchak HaKohen, by Eitan Hachster in honor of his wife Shula, giving birth to their little girl Emuna Orly. Big mazel tov, they should have a lot of nachas. And also dedicated in memory of the Chayal HaKadosh, Ephraim ben Shmuel, Hashem Yikom Damo, whose Yortzeit is the 15th of Teves, to whom Tefillah and Torah were of utmost importance. So we thank Liat and Shmuel Jackman for sponsoring in memory of their son. Thank you so much for all those who sponsored. Also, one more public service announcement. There is a old mitzvah and halacha, which has become a new campaign and initiative, and that is Shnayim Mikra V'Yachad Targum. It's not mentioned in the Mishnah, but it is mentioned in the Gemara, the weekly obligation of Jews to review the Torah portion of the week twice, together with Unklus, the Teich, the translation, and maybe updated in contemporary times, not to Unklus, but to Rashi. Of course, that obligation begins every year, the new cycle, Bereishis. But if you have not been learning Shnayim Mikra V'Yachad Targum, there's no better time to begin than Sefer Shmos, Parsha Shmos. After all, the word Shmos is Rashi Tevos, is an acronym for Shnayim Mikra V'Yachad Targum. So there's a new initiative from the Shnayim Yomi group. Art Scroll put out a new Chumash, Shnayim Mikra V'Yachad Targum, and there's a new one with the Free State of Florida logo on the bottom. Doesn't say Free State of Florida, that's just what we call it here in Florida. So Shnayim Mikra Florida, Shnayim Mikra Florida. You can join the WhatsApp group, and in the WhatsApp group you get a daily 2-minute Dvar Torah on that day's Aliyah. Happens to be this week of Sefer Shmos, Parsha Shmos. Yours truly has been posting those videos daily this week. I've been putting them in the Parsha WhatsApp group, our Parsha WhatsApp group as well, which you should be part of for an update on the schedule. Join it. You get the daily Aliyah, daily Dvar Torah on the Aliyah, and you should get this Chumash because it is fantastic. Page 292. Ve'ele Shmos b'nei Yisrael b'ayim Mitzrayimah, Eis Yaakov Ishu ve'eso ba'u. These are the names of the children of the Jewish people. Hu haba'im. Translate the word haba'im for me. No, does not mean came. Haba'im means coming. Lashon Hove, in the present tense. Why does it say Haba'im? We know that Sefer Bereishis, the last book, ended with the 70 family members of Yaakov having come. They came, past tense. They're there. They set up shop. They're living. They're now subjugated and persecuted, and they're spreading and promulgating, but they came down a long time ago. We know that Yaakov lived in Mitzrayim for how long? 17 years. By the time we're beginning Sefer Shmos, the Jewish people are entrenched. They've been living. They're not new immigrants. They've been there a while. So why is the word haba'im, which is present tense, used when it should be asher ba'u? Asher ba'u. Sort of Isaac Ozban Zatzal, one of the founding Rosh Yeshiva, tells Cleveland, HaTorah Mi'ida Ashivte Kashil Marosha Ibn Mitzrayim Tekuvazman Arucha. Even though the Jewish people were in Egypt for a long time, not only Yaakov, but also his sons, the Jewish people remained in perpetuity in a status and state of, we've just arrived. We're new immigrants. We just came. We're coming. They never settled in. They never assimilated. They never became part of the Egyptian culture, part of the Egyptian lifestyle. Their attitude and mentality were greeners, we're immigrants, we just got here. We don't fit in, we're not entirely. We're ger v'toshav, like Avram Avinu taught when he negotiated for the stay Ephron. Mm-hmm. We are both at the same time, simultaneously, ger v'toshav, an alien and a resident, a citizen and a guest and a visitor. That's the Jewish mindset to every galus we're in. Eretz Yisrael, of course, is the exception. That's when we're finally home. That's where we belong. But everywhere else, it's temporary. I'm just getting here. I just got here. I'm not unpacking my suitcase in this galus because I'm standing ready. The Mashiach's coming, and I'm going to where I belong. I'm just passing through. I'm just visiting. I'm only here temporarily. And therefore, the Torah introduces this entire saga of what was a 210-year stay in Mitzrayim of suffering and servitude, Haba'im, that the Jewish people never were Ba'u. They never came, they never arrived. Similar to Chassam Sofer, he quotes in the Sefer L'Sitcha Elyon, what the Shvatim said to Yaakov Avinu, Ve'agidu lo le'mor, Od Yosef chai, V'chihu Moshe b'chol Eretz Mitzrayim. They told Yaakov, Yosef is still alive, and he's the Moshe, he's the leader of all of Egypt. Ve'afeg libo ki lo ha'amin lahem. And Yaakov's heart melted because he didn't believe them. L'chor lo amr ma'ashe Yosef tzivo osam lomar. They didn't repeat what Yosef instructed them to. Ve'asimu la'av la'paro la'adon l'chol be'so. So why? Why didn't they repeat what Yosef said? Why did they change it and tell Yaakov that he's Moshel b'chol Eretz Mitzrayim? So the explanation says the Chassam Sofer, Hashvatam Yadusha Mashachash of Yaakov ben Yonash Yosef, because Yaakov wasn't concerned. What's Yosef's job title? What's his portfolio? What's his net worth? What did Yaakov want to know? What was Yaakov worried about? All he cared about is Yosef still Yosef. Does Yosef still carry himself like a Jew, like a Yid? Is he walking and living my Mesorah? Is Yosef assimilated? Has he lost everything I taught him? Or does he stand out? Is he still Yosef? So they don't say Avla Paro V'Adon L'Chol Beiso. The fact that he's the viceroy, the vice president, the fact that he's the secretary of finance, the fact that he's running the whole economy, they'll get to that with Yaakov. But that's not what they open with. Because what matters most, what Yaakov is most concerned about is he's Moshel B'Chol Eretz. He's Moshel. It means that he hasn't given in. He has not surrendered. He's not assimilated. He hasn't lost his identity. He knows who he is. He knows how he lives. He knows what matters and what is his mission. And that's therefore what they open Moshel B'Chol Eretz Mitzrayim. He's Moshel. He's a ruler and leader. He regulates himself. He hasn't given in to the urge or impulse to assimilate and be part of everyone else. So that's what Rav Ozban says. Haba'im, not Ba'u, we didn't come, Haba'im, we are still coming, number one. And number two, the Chassam Sofer, Moshel, this is what he was worried about Yosef, that the Jewish people, we don't lose our identity, we continue to come. In fact, the Medrash says, it was in that merit that we were redeemed. We kept our names, our clothing, and our language. There's different Midrashim that actually have, you can find and replace some of these with others. We didn't speak Lashon Hara about one another. We didn't reveal secrets. Interesting, there's a Midrash that says Jewish people were redeemed in the merit. We weren't Megala Sod. We didn't reveal secrets. There's a lot to say about that. But we kept our identity, our names, our clothing, our language. We didn't blend in. We didn't assimilate. We stood out. We stood with pride and we had Jewish practice. We wore our yarmulke. We didn't take it off. We didn't put on a baseball cap. We weren't afraid. This is who I am. This is how I live. This is how I'm proud to be. Haba'im. I don't look like everyone else. I don't fit in with everyone else. I haven't arrived, and now I've assimilated. I'm a greener. I just got here. I still stand out. I'm still just passing through, and that's the secret to our survival. That's the way to navigate in Gullus, to be part of and apart from, at the same time, Ger Vitoshav. Fast forward. Pasuk Ches. Moving right along. So what happens? We then repeat who came down. By the way, this is the same. It says, V'Yosef haya b'Mitzrayim, one of the little Divrei Torah I gave in the Shnei Mikra project so far, the first Aliyah was, V'Yosef haya b'Mitzrayim. Why is the Torah repeating? We know where Yosef. Why do we have to say he was b'Mitzrayim? Elishmos b'nei Yisrael b'Mitzrayim. We know we're telling the story of the Jewish people where? In Egypt. So why do I have to reference, and Yosef was in Egypt. Yeah, duh, Yosef was in Egypt. The answer is, V'Yosef haya, he was still the same Yosef b'Mitzrayim. That's what Rashi says. Halohu ubanav hayu b'chlal shvat. Ma balam denu ki lo yadu yod shayim Mitzrayim lo diacha tzidkasa shal Yosef hu Yosef aras son aviv hu Yosef shayim b'Mitzrayim v'nasa melech v'omed b'tzidko. The same Yosef who was the simple shepherd when no one knew of him and no one heard of him and no one was watching him. He wasn't an influencer. He wasn't viral. No one was taking selfies with him. He was the simple, humble, modest shepherd Yosef. Even when he was the viceroy leading all of Egypt, he hadn't changed. It didn't go to his head. He didn't lose any part of who he was, his humility, his modesty, also his piety. He was the same Yosef. V'Yosef haya b'Mitzrayim. In Mitzrayim, he remained Yosef. He never lost his sense of who he was, his sense of Yosef. And a new king arose over Egypt, Asher Yosef, who did not know Yosef. A new king arose. Says the Megid Yosef, we're familiar. Rashi tells us, Rabbi Shmuel, there is a debate among our two great rabbis, Rabbi Shmuel, Chad Amar, Chadash Mamish. When the Torah testifies a new king arose over Egypt, what does it mean? Literally or figuratively? Is it a new king, a new person, a new election, a new appointment, new succession, a new king literally, or a new king? That means it was the same person, same name, same face, same person, but something happened to him. Something came over him. Chad Amar Chadash Mamish, V'chad Amar Nischadshu Gzeirosav. He became different in his edicts. He became different in his policies. He became a different person. Says the Megid Yosef of Yosef Sorotskin, L'chora, Lo Yuvan L'shita Sh'nischadshu Gzeirosav Mahu Lashon Melech Chadash. If you want to say he changed his policies, what does that mean? Why did the Torah tell us a new person? He's not new. He's the same person. Same social security number, same birthday, same person, same online profile, just new policies. So why would we couch or communicate someone with new policies as a Melech Chadash, as a new person? The name is Super Medrash, says the Megid Yosef, he quotes a Medrash, says the following, Paro hisnaged latzas sarav laharbos gerosov al Yehudim, ad kedei kach she'asarim horidu meches ha-malchus. Paro's advisors told him not to increase the policy of persecution against the Jewish people. And he didn't listen to them until Shasarim Horiduhu Mikasa Malchus. They took him, he was no longer the king. And they didn't put him back until he agreed to follow their advice. I'm sorry. He was his Nagid. They said to increase the persecution. He hesitated. They removed him from his position of power until he would agree to follow their advice, their counsel, to indeed intensify the persecution. This is the Paro who Yosef interpreted his dreams. This is the Paro who Yosef saved the economy, saved him and his legacy, saved his family and his people. And he loved Yosef. He gave Yosef Goshen, and he embraced Yosef's father Yaakov and the whole family, and he allowed Yosef to go up and bury his father. He had tremendous affection. Yosef was his mentee, his protege. He loved Yosef. The same Paro who loved Yosef and his progeny all of a sudden now turns? How could he turn so radically? How could he pivot to be so unrecognizable? The answer is, he was on the take. When his advisors and his counsel said, we won't support you. We're not taking care of you. We're not paying you unless you persecute, unless you change. And once he changed, he was like Melech Chadash. Once he changed, he was like an entirely new person. So much so that today, you say the word Paro, wake any Jew in the middle of the night. Not with frogs on their nose and frogs on their toes, but wake any Jew in the middle of the night and say the word Paro. Word association, Paro. No one says, oh, Paro. Yosef had such a good relationship. He was Yosef's mentor. He took such good care of the Jewish people. He let us set up our own community. Synonymous with Paro is villain. Russia, wicked, evil, persecutor, oppressor, dictator. Paro goes down. His legacy, Shmo Nikva Betoldos Yisrael, his name is synonymous. His name was set in stone. His legacy among the Jewish people is an arch enemy. B'zeo Melech Chadash. And that's why it wasn't just that he had new policies. He became a new, unrecognizable person. Kol kach hishtaneh mikatza el hakatza b'yachso liyehudim. So unrecognizable. He had gone from one extreme to another, a lover, protector, defender of the Jewish people, to the arch enemy, nemesis, persecutor, tormentor. Ki'ilu haya adam acher melech chadash. Now, if I learned this Megid Yosef with you a couple of years ago, you'd say, okay, nice insight. I don't really know. That's not familiar. I've never experienced. I can't relate. But now, you know what I see in between the lines of the Megid Yosef? It says on the side, a little footnote says, Ian Tucker Carlson. As more things change, the more they stay the same. And if you want to understand anti-Semitism and anti-Semites, just open our Chumash. Because this is a story that unfortunately has many sequels. and continues to tell itself over and over again. And because, you know, on social media, online, as a pastime now, some people, in order to show the difference, you know, they'll have side-by-side screens. And it's the Tucker Carlson in 2017 in Fox News, Tucker Carlson today, right? Just this week, they're doing it about Venezuela. He was calling for taking out the leader of Venezuela and how terrible Venezuela and how much Venezuela. And now, well, Venezuela is very conservative and, right, side by side. And you could do that about, most significantly, the Jewish people. And what happened? Qatar. What happened? Going viral, more followers, more influence, more advertisers, more money. Megyn Kelly, sadly, the same thing. People who were greatest defenders, people who understood and stood by us, advocates of our people, could so radically shift and change. Melech Hadash. It's brand new. I don't know who they are. I don't recognize what they're saying. It's not just that their words and their policies. It's not just that their pundits whose take on everything changed. They changed. They changed. Because when a person says, I'm going to lose my position of prominence, Paro's advisors said, you're done. We're taking you down. We're putting up in the primary someone against you. Unless you follow our advice, unless you adopt our policies against the Jews, you're out. And what happens when that happens? People resign. When the deep state says, we're not going to be supporting you, then they have no future. And not only do they change their policies, they become different people. They become different people. Vayakam melech chadash. Not only literally a new king, but now we understand based on this insight and based sadly on our own experience that you can have the same social security number, the same birthday, the same fingerprints, the same person, and they become a new person, unrecognizable, because when they want to continue or increase their influence and their power and their fortune, they become a new person, a melech chadash. Sadly, that was true of the anti-Semite of your Paro, who now is synonymous with tyranny and goes down as a villain of our people. And it's true in our day. It's true in real time. It's happening today. Rabbi Sachs, in the new Rabbi Sachs Chumash, how long can I keep calling it the new Rabbi Sachs Chumash? In the new Rabbi Sachs Chumash also has a description. And he says, Asher lo yada es Yosef, this new Paro, whether literally or figuratively, didn't know Yosef. Bereishis ends on an almost serene note. Yaakov has found his long-lost son. The family's been reunited. Yosef has forgiven his brothers. Under his protection and influence, the family has settled in Goshen, one of the most prosperous regions of Egypt. They now have homes, property, food, protection of Yosef, and the favor of Paro. It must have seemed one of the golden moments of Avram's family's history. Yet when the curtain went down last week, just last Shabbos, people, when the curtain went down on Vayechi, oh, finally, harmony and peace, reunion and unity. Finally, that shalva that Yaakov was bikesh, that serenity that he so badly craved and longed for, finally, when the curtain came down, he had it. And it seemed like one of the golden moments of Avram's family's history. And then, as has happened so often since, Vayaka melech chadash, asher lo yadas Yosef, a political climate change. The family falls out of favor. Paro tells his advisors, you see the Jewish people are many, more powerful than we. Let us deal wisely with them in case they increase. And so the whole mechanism of oppression moves into operation. Forced labor that turns into slavery that becomes attempted genocide. The story is engraved in our memory. We tell it every year. And in summary, form in our prayers every day. It is part of what it is to be a Yid, a Jew. Yet, there's one phrase that shines out from the narrative. Look at Pasuk Yud Beis. If you're watching and you see me waving wildly, it's not because I see someone I know. It's for some reason there are flies who are the reincarnation of those who skipped the Parsha class. And Hashem makes them now attend every week and torture me. Should be a kapara for all of us, the flies and me. In Pasuk Yud Beis, Vakasher Yanu Oso Kein Yirbeh V'chein Yifrotz. We reference it at the Seder. The more they oppressed, the more we increased and spread. And the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. Writes Rabbi Sachs, this, no less than oppression itself, is part of what it means to be a Jew. Let me say that again. This pasuk, that the more they oppressed us and the more they tortured us, the stronger, the bigger, the more faithful we became, is in itself, no less than oppression itself, part of what it means to be a Jew. The worse things get, the stronger we become. Jews are the people who not only survive, but thrive in adversity. Jewish history is not merely a story of Jews enduring catastrophes that might have spelled the end to less tenacious groups. It is, in fact, that after every disaster, Jews renewed themselves. They discovered some hitherto hidden reservoir of spirit that fueled new forms of collective self-expression as the carriers of God's message to the world. What an important point Rabbi Sacks is making. When we read the beginning of Parshas Shmos, so if you're good, you're already taking notes for the Pesach Seder. You're already taking notes for Pesach, for your Divrei Torah. And what do we always focus on? They tried to kill us, miracles, 10 plagues, splitting of the sea, we survived. But we're missing part of the core story, central theme of the story. As important as it is to be ingrained in our collective memory, that they tried to destroy us and kill us, and that was a cycle that got repeated, so too, maybe even more importantly, to ingrain in our collective consciousness that every time they did, we bounced back stronger, bigger, greater, more unified, and having more faith. And why do I share this insight? Because it's beautiful, and it's true, and you can track it through our history, including in the aftermath of the Holocaust. But have we not in the last 2 years since October 7th? And it brings to mind that great expression, which is not Jewish in origin. They tried to bury us, but they planted us instead. On October 7th, they tried to bury us, but they planted us. The IDF, our heroes on the front lines, the Jewish people, came roaring back, fought and continue to fight, lest we think it's over. There are still heroes in Gaza and Lebanon and Syria and pulling off incredible missions, incredible missions. In fact, Israel just captured Maduro from Venezuela. I'm joking. Chas v'shalom. Of course not. It wasn't Israel. Israel had nothing to do with it whatsoever, except for probably teaching the know-how about how to pull off such incredible, incredible missions. It's okay to laugh. And if the government is, I don't know, monitoring, or Candace is watching the Parsha Shir, that was a joke. There's no conspiracy here. But that's what Rabbi Sacks is telling us. In our collective consciousness must be not only the suffering that we've endured through the generations, but also the tenacity we have inside ourselves to bounce back. After every period of darkness in our history, there was an enormous burst of light. Maybe most notably, profoundly, in the aftermath of the Holocaust, the unimaginable at the time, birth of the State of Israel. In the aftermath of October 7th, almost as unimaginable, the destruction of Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, change of the entire landscape of the Middle East. Every time after the darkness, there's a burst of light, and that happens because the Jewish people are tenacious. And that's this pasuk, Yud Beis. Kasher ye'anu oso, the more they torment us, ken yirbe v'chein yifrotz. We will bounce back. The population explosion in the DP camps following the Holocaust was the unbelievable expression and demonstration of courage and of faith that the world was worth yet bringing people into. That's a challenge from our Parsha too. Amram didn't understand it. He wants to give up. There's no future. There's no hope. How could we have more children? He separates from his wife. And it takes his daughter Miriam to say, there's going to turn around. There's going to be a light after this darkness. This world is yet worth believing in and bringing children into. And we've repeated that cycle over and over again. Perek Aleph, Pasuk Tesvav. Moving right along, turn the page. Aleph Tesvav. Vayomer Melech Mitzrayim l'Mialdosa Ivrios, and the king of Egypt tells thee, translate the words Mialdosa Ivrios. It's not a trick question, translate. So Art Scroll I see here translates as Hebrew midwives. Rabbi Sacks says midwives of the Hebrews. Ooh, interesting, interessant. Art Scroll says, again, Art Scroll translates as, the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, says Rabbi Sacks, the king of Egypt said to the midwives of the Hebrews. What are they debating in their taich, in their translation? What's going on over here? Paro spoke to them. Who are they? White writes Rabbi Sacks, midwives to the Hebrews. Who are Shifra and Pua? The truth is, we do not know. One Medrash identifies them with Moshe's mother, Yocheved, and sister Miriam, using Midrashic technique of identifying unknown characters with characters who are more elaborated. Gemara in Sota, Daf Yud Aleph, Amud Beis, Rashi there. You know, we tend to make this mistake. In our childhood, we learned a Medrash, and then in our mind, that becomes the authoritative Medrash that that is the only way of looking at it. So we all learned as little kids, who were Shifra and Pua? Those are other names for Yocheved and Miriam, Moshe's mother and sister. They were these midwives. And that's the only approach. But there are many Midrashim. And there are different opinions among the Midrashim. And Rabbi Sacks quotes, in describing them in the Torah, uses an ambiguous phrase, Hamialdos ha'ivrios, which could mean either the Hebrew midwives or midwives to the Hebrews. On the second interpretation, they may not have been Hebrews at all, but Egyptians. This is the view taken. It's a good thing you're all sitting down. Abarbanel. The Abarbanel says these weren't Miriam and Yocheved. These were Egyptian righteous Gentiles. Even then, they were righteous among the Gentiles. You know how today we're sort of living this life, wandering among those who are friendly or nice to us? Yeah, but would you hide me? Would you put me in your attic? Would you hide me in your crawl space? That's sort of our litmus test of the people who come over and say, I'm so sorry for what's happening. I stand with the Jewish people in Israel. And you say, that's nice, but would you hide me? Would you be a righteous Gentile among the nations? Says the Abarbanel and the Shadal, Shmuel David Lutzato, say these two commentaries, that in fact, Mialdos Ivrios does not mean Hebrew midwives. It's not Miriam and Yocheved. It means midwives to the Hebrews, who were not Jewish at all. They were Egyptian. Shadal's reasoning is simple. Could Paro realistically have expected Hebrew women to murder their own people's children? If you think about it, it's a much more compelling opinion. If you're Paro and you have to find someone to carry out killing all the firstborn male, who are you going to ask? Representatives of the very people that you're trying to kill? What's the likelihood that they're going to comply with that edict? It makes much more sense. It's much more persuasive or compelling to say you're going to find from your side, from your team, from the oppressor. And therefore, they're Abarbanel and Shadal say exactly that. Rather than decide one way or the other, it seems clear that the Torah's ambiguity on this point is deliberate. We do not know who they are or which people they belong to because their particular form of moral courage transcends nationality and race. Says Rabbi Sacks, who's right? We don't know. The Torah intentionally is ambiguous. It writes it in a way that you could read it either way. Why? Because the Torah is not focused on the pedigree of who they are. The Torah is focused on the moral courage they display. In essence, they're being asked to commit a crime against humanity. And the fact that they refuse to tells us something about the ethical parameters of humanity. Though Shifra and Pua are seemingly minor figures in the narrative, they are giants in the story of humanity. All we know about them is that they feared Hashem and did not do as the king of Egypt ordered them. In those words, a precedent is set, which will ultimately become the basis of the Declaration of Human Rights. Shifra and Pua, by refusing to obey in a moral order, refine the moral imagination of the world. Shifra and Pua, continues Rabbi Sacks, are first of six courageous women who will play a vital part in the story of Israel's redemption in this parsha. Women, b'zchus nashim tzidkaniyos nigalu, we were redeemed in the merit of righteous women. Who are they? Can we identify all six? Let's go. Yocheved and Miriam, Paro's daughter, and Moshe's wife Tzipora. So Shifra and Pua, who might be the same as or different than Yocheved and Miriam, Bisya bas Paro, and Tzipora, Moshe's wife. Moshe may be the central character in the unfolding drama, but without these women, there'd be no Moshe. Their moral courage is a vital element in the story. So Moshe has the limelight, Moshe has the spotlight, Moshe has the fanfare, Moshe is the mouthpiece, but without these six women, there's no Moshe. Their righteousness. It's notable that only two, Yocheved and Miriam, are clearly Jewish. Paro's daughter is not. Tzipora, certainly in her origin, is not. And the identity of Shifra and Pua are uncertain, intentionally ambiguous. The entire Shmos narrative is a delicate counterpoint between the particularity of the Jewish people, we'll see later in our parasha, B'ni B'chori Yisrael, and the universality of the moral law. And we see this several times in the following chapters. Not every nation is expected to be holy, but every nation is expected to be moral. So we are presented with role models, such as these non-Israelite women, whose principled stand against tyranny and persecution transcends all ethnic and cultural boundaries. So, it's a good thing you were sitting down, but Shifra and Pua may not be Yocheved and Miriam. They may not be Jewish at all. That's not some modern commentator. It's not Rabbi Sacks. It's the Abarbanel and others who say it, which is also a very profound statement, that we should have an expectation and demand of the world basic moral courage. The Torah is not only giving a prescription for how Jewish people are meant to live, but in such circumstances, all of humanity is meant to rise to the occasion and to the moment, to live with the moral courage, and to act in that way. The next pasuk, Aleph Tezayin. Vayomer bialatchem es avriot risim es alav naim, im benhu vahamiten oso, im basi vachaya, says the Torah. And he said, what did Paro, what did he say to these women, whoever they were? When you deliver the Hebrew women, you see them on the birth stool. If it is a son, you're to kill him. If it is a daughter, she shall live. Says the Megid Yosef, Rav Yosef Sirotskin. Hinei Gemara, the Gemara Pesachim Daf Kuf Ches tells us, Noshim Chayavas Bar Bekosas Halalu, Af Heina Yuba Oso Anes. Women are obligated in the four cups of wine at the Pesach Seder. Why? Four cups of wine, if you had to categorize them in halacha as a mitzvah, how would you categorize them? They are a classic mitzvah saseh sheyesh. Mitzvah saseh sheyesh ben zman groma. It is a classic time-bound mitzvah. When do you drink the four cups of wine? In Israel, one night a year. Here, two nights a year. At the Pesach Seder. That is a classic time-bound mitzvah. Women are exempt from time-bound mitzvah. And yet, the Gemara Pesachim tells us, like Mikra Megillah, like other mitzvahs maybe, like Lechem Mishnah, like others, they're obligated in this time-bound mitzvah. Why? Because Afena Yuba Oso Anes. They too were part of the miracle. When the Torah, when Chazal comment that women become obligated because they were part of the miracle, what do we mean? Part of the miracle means they were the catalyst of the miracle? They caused the miracle? It's Machlokas Rashi Tosfos. Or they were beneficiaries of the miracle. That they too were threatened and the miracle saved them. So Rashi says they were the catalyst. And the Rashi goes through in each case how they were the ones who saved the Jewish people. Esther and Purim is easy. B'shchus Nashim Tzidkanios in the case of the four cups of wine and so on. Tosfos brings a Yerushalmi. Gam heim ayu b'chlas sakana v'nitzlu. Not that they were the catalyst or cause, but they were the beneficiary. That they too were a target, they were threatened, and they too were saved, and therefore they have to join the community of men, the greater Klal Yisrael, in thanking Hashem. Now, how were they saved? In what way were they threatened? Here, the pasuk just said, "Im benhu," it was only the boys who were going to be murdered. The girls were given life. The girls would survive. So, in what way were they threatened? That afena yuboso anes. That they survived. So the Mordechai Megillah writes, "Afa gav de paro lo gaza el al zcharim mikomakam hanashim lo hayicholos leskayim below zcharim." Even though it's true, only the men were targeted for murder, but the women can't live without the men. There's two ways you could understand that. Either, in order for new girls to be born, you need men to marry women. In other words, there's no continuity for men or women if you're missing either of the genders. Or the classic way that women can't live without their men. Vabir bezeh, you choose which one you want to follow. Vabir bezeh nira, shanashim ayunela tzos leschatein im mitzrim. V'shem agzer al nekevas chamur me'agzer al azcharam. Uwa, says the Megid Yosef. If there were no Jewish men because they were all murdered, if the women wanted to survive and had a continuity, who would they have to marry? The Egyptians. Whose punishment would be worse then? The boys who were murdered or the women who lived but had to live marrying their persecutor, the tormentor, the only way that they would survive. Od nira, alternatively, shalakachas b'koach pribit nashal isha lakros atinak mechabuka shal aim amanas lahamisa hu onish yoser gadol le'im latinok. Tearing a baby out of a mother's arms to kill him is more painful to the mother than it is to the child. So who was punished more, the men or the women, the boys or their mothers? It's true that it was the boys who were killed. So why do we say, afena yuba oso anes? Because a mother, for a baby to be torn out of the arms of a mother, is more painful than for the baby himself. And therefore, that's why, afena yuba oso anes. Very interesting, Megid Yosef. I never thought For years we knew. Four cups of wine, because they too were saved. Saved generally. Paro wanted to kill everyone generally. But that's not true. He didn't want to kill everyone. He only wanted to kill the men. So how can we say Afenayu? So either of these two answers of the Meged Yosef. Perek Beis, Pasuk Gimel. Moving right along. So, a man from the house of Levi went and took a woman from the house of Levi, and she had a boy, and she hid him 3 months, but she could no longer anymore. She hid him for 3 months. She couldn't hide him anymore. She took him in a wicker basket smeared with clay and pitch, placed the child into it, placed it among the reeds at the bank of the river. His sister stationed herself at a distance to see what was going to happen, Taka, with this young man, with this boy. Back in the Lesitcha Elyon, he quotes a beautiful insight from Rav Volba. And Rav Volba writes the following. The Gemara Tzota says, Mikal tzadikim, shemamonim chavav aleim migufan, she'ein poshtan yedeim begezel. They smeared, I don't know if that's the technical term, but the outside of this basket with what? With goma, with pitch, which is dam of mu'atan, says Rashi. It's very inexpensive. It's very cheap material. So basically, they're trying to save the baby, and they know the only way to do it will put the baby Moshe in the basket, and the basket's got to make it floating on the river. So Yocheved goes on Amazon in order to buy something to smear the basket with so that it won't sink in the river. And she sees, you know, tar is $100 and pitch is $18.99. She goes with the pitch. Why? Because tzaddikim, mamonim chavav alei migufan. Their money is more valuable than themselves, than their body, than their survival. How is that a positive quality? She went all cheap, even on saving her son. So Rav Volba explained the following. Imroim adam shemavazvez es kaspo, if you see somebody who wastes and squanders money, if you see someone who throws away money, now, again, the assumption here was not that the basket would sink. She went cheap in a way that he would die, he would drown. It meant either material would be good, but she didn't go for the fancy. She didn't go for, you know, there's a video going viral right now of Mori Varabi of Moshe Weinberger. He went off in a holy rant against the Jewish obsession with materialism today, what he thinks has gotten out of hand. You can watch it, find it on your own. That's what Chazal were saying, that tzaddikim are chasim al mamonim. They understand that money is acquired through blood, sweat, and tears, that a person had to sacrifice for that money. What went into earning it? Could have been learning, but you gave up time to work. You could have been with your family, but you were working to take care, to earn. In the Gemara, what's the Hebrew word that's used for money? Damim. Why blood? Why do we call money blood? Because earning money takes blood, sweat, and tears for the people who have to earn it and work for it and achieve it. And if you worked hard for your money, you'll be much more careful with it than if you just inherit it or won it. So much so, says Rav Volba, if you see somebody who's mevazvez es kaspo, who squanders and wastes and is frivolous with money, irresponsible with money, throws away money, is silly with money, then you should check how that money was earned, because likely it wasn't scrupulous. Lo bekesef belvad advar mamurim, gam beshav kesef. Haya hamashkiach ma'or al tzirim shatzovrim chovos al cheshbon horeyem. And Rav Volba would rant. Rav Volba, who was nifter, he passed away years ago. I can't imagine what he'd say today. Of young people who walk around with their parents' credit card and they buy and they treat themselves to luxuries that their parents who earned that money and worked so hard never would. They get the best of everything and they treat themselves regularly to the triple caramel latte, iced coffee, extra rolls of the most specialty kind of the sushi, and they go get the special, shake, what do they call it? Fruit, whatever on the Friday in Yerushalayim, I won't say. And why? They didn't earn that money. And it's much easier to spend it and squander it when you didn't give your dumim for it. And in that moment, when it doesn't, it feels like monopoly money. Zelle and what's the other one? Venmo and Zelle. You know, the danger of Uber, Ubers are amazing because they're tremendously convenient. But you don't feel like you spent any money on it because you just had an app and you ordered. You never actually had to hand money or even swipe a card. So it feels like it was free until the statement comes, the bank statement comes. So whether it's Uber or Get taxis in Israel. And it was Revolbe who said, young couples who are being supported and not living a kollel lifestyle, but they're living the lifestyle of the rich and famous because it's on someone else's account, that's not the way of tzaddikim. Mikan l'tzaddikim shemamon u'chavav alayim migufam. Tzorach ladas sheben Torah shemunyan l'tzmoch l'gadel tamachacham. A ben Torah who wants to grow and blossom to be a great righteous person. Hatanai lios tzaddik b'mamono. The first sign is be righteous with your money. Be responsible. Have a budget. Live within it. Be modest. Understand your place, your time, your age, whether it's yours, whether you earned it. And if you live a life that doesn't, it's not disciplined and regulated, you know, the people who spend irresponsibly and squander money and don't take care of it are the same people who don't tuck in their chair. For the record, just saying. All right, everyone relax. I'm just saying. By the way, we got a camera in the back. We have a camera in the back, and when Shira is over, we know exactly which one of you don't tuck your chair back in. There's an article I wrote last week. My article last week was about my pet peeve, but it wasn't only my own. Rav Yerucham in Das Torah quotes his Rebbe, the Alter of Kelm, if someone didn't tuck their chair in, he would rebuke them as if they violated Shabbos. So significant to the Alter of Kelm of being mesudr, of tucking in your chair, he equated it with Chilul Shabbos. Not because he was, you know, suffered from being compulsive. It was because he understood that if you don't have Seder, it's essentially what Revolbe is saying here. If you're not mesudr and responsible with your money, then you also won't be with who you are, with your life, with your lifestyle, with your holiness. All that you see from here, because of this Rashi Tevas Goma, that what she spent on was not luxurious, and it wasn't frivolous, and it didn't need to be the luxury brand, and it wasn't a waste of money, because tzaddikim are chasam amamonam, mamonam chaviv aleihem migufam, and says Revolbe, that's not just good financial practice, that's religious practice. That's the point that Revolbe is making. And that's the point that, little me, I was making in my article. Lest you think that that silly pet peeve, who cares if you tuck in your chair? Who cares about these little things in life? The answer is the little things in life reveal the bigger things in life. And as I put at the end of the article, I think it's a big flag on a date in both directions. But if the other person doesn't say please and thank you to the waiter, if the other person doesn't tuck in the chair when they get up, if the other person doesn't do the basic common courtesies, if the other person squanders and wastes money, why? Because then they're dating on their parents' credit card. It's for another time, but it happens to be I paid for every date. It was my hard-earned money from my summers that I worked, and I'm better off because of it. And today, people go on dates. They're eating in restaurants. They're not even the age of anything, and they're going out on a date to the restaurants that we go to once a year for a special occasion, maybe not even once a year. It's too often. Okay, enough of this. I have a lot to say. Back to our regular scheduled program. Back to the parsha. Okay, where were we? Atikachlo perik. Ah, perikim apasik dalad. Ayvei. Perikim apasik dalad. Page 300. Moshe. Now we're fast forwarding. Moshe grows up, and he leaves the palace, and he sees the people are suffering, and he smites an Egyptian. Thank God for post parsha Shmos. Otherwise, we'd never use the word smite. He smites the Egyptian. Dasan va'aviram tell on him. He has to flee for his life. He goes to Midian. And there he meets, of course, his wife. Where do Jews go to meet their wives? The well. And now he's married. And what do Jews do for a living? Great Jewish leaders. The prerequisite to emerge as a great Jewish leader is first you have to put your time in as a shepherd. Moshe is the shepherd of the sheep of the flock of Yisro Hishver, his father-in-law, who was the Kohen of Midian, the priest of Midian. And he guided the sheep far into the wilderness. He arrives at the mountain of God towards Chorev. Pasuk Dalad. Vayar Hashem Kisar Liros. Moshe now is walking and he turns to see. God calls him from this bush. It's on fire but not being consumed. Vayomer Moshe Moshe. Vayomer Hineni. He calls him Moshe Moshe. And Moshe says, here I am. And we get to our first Rabbi Soloveitchik of the day. Vayar Hashem Kisar Liros. God saw that he turned to see. By the way, the Medrash says, Kisar Liros, he turned to see. What impressed God? That he turned to see the bush on fire not being consumed? No. Vayar Hashem Kisar Liros, Liros, Besivlo Sam. It was when Moshe left the palace to see the suffering of the Jewish people. He was Nosei Ba'olam Chavero, but he had empathy and felt the pain of his people. Moshe easily at that time could have hid in the safety and security of the palace, but he didn't. He saw the suffering of his people, and he went out. Kisar liros, liros besivlosam. But Rabbi Soloveitchik has a different interpretation. When Hashem sees how Moshe responds to the sight of the bush, he removes the angel and he appears to Moshe. Hashem now resides in the bush, not the angel. Once Moshe reacted to the bush appropriately, the Jews came under the supervision and protection, not of an angel, but of God himself. The Ramban explains that in contrast to other nations, Jewish historical destiny is guided directly by the Almighty. Earlier, the name Elohim was used. Now, it came to pass in those many days, they cried out, and the cry ascended to Elohim. And Elohim heard their cry, and Elohim saw them, and Elohim knew. The name Yudkei Vavkei, the Tetragrammaton, does not appear in that previous chapter. When Hashem suffered with them, when he shared in their distress, he was Elohim. But they still had to wait for redemption. Yudkei Vavkei was not there yet. Only when Moshe said, Asura na ve'ereh, let me turn now and see, only now Vayar Hashem. And now we change which name we use. In the previous chapter, it was Elohim. We weren't introduced to Yudkei Vavkei. Now it's not Elohim, it's Vayar Hashem, Yudkei Vavkei. Now the Tetragrammaton appears. The time of the redemption has arrived. Elohim refers to God, who requires a Jew have faith, patience, and perseverance. It's very hard to wait. And yet, the Jew waits and waits. Every day he says the Ani Mamin, I believe in the coming of Mashiach, and even though he may tarry, I will wait for him every day. The Jew who communicates with Elohim is greater than the Jew who communicates with Yudkei Vavkei, the fulfiller of promises. When Hashem bestows grace upon the people, it is not so difficult to be a Jew. During the long, lonely night of exile, Yudkei Vavkei did not reveal himself. Nevertheless, the Jew did not lose his faith in Elohim. The Jew who waits is great indeed. When Moshe said, let me now turn and see, Yudkei Vavkei appeared. The time to fulfill the promise was at hand. The redemption began not on the first night of Pesach, when the actual Exodus took place, but when Moshe was confronted by Hashem, even before he was convinced to accept his calling. When does the redemption begin? Not the first night of Pesach. Not when the plagues begin. Not when he says it's time to pack your things, we're getting out. Redemption begins when Moshe turns to see. When we see the suffering, when we involve ourselves, when we understand that we are partner in Hashem in bringing that very geula. Says the Lasitcha Elyon, another Lasitcha Elyon, popular with us today. Kisar Liros, the Sforno. On the words Kisar Liros, the Sforno has two words. Right here, Moshe's walking along, and there's this unusual, supernatural, extraordinary phenomena taking place. There's a bush on fire, and it's not being consumed. Einenu Ukal. They love to say, how do you know a grandchild is called an einikel? Where do you see that in the Torah? Einenu Ukal. That once a person has a grandchild, now it's not consumed. Einenu Ukal, einikel. Now you have a future. Now the fire continues to burn. Einikel, einenu Ukal. Good. Kisaler, everyone else sees it and keeps walking. Everyone else walks, doesn't notice it, doesn't think of it. Why does Moshe notice it? Says the Sforno, two words. Lehizbonein badavar. Kisar Leros, he turns to see. Why does he turn to see? Lehizbonein bedavar. What does the word lehizbonein mean? To be contemplative. To contemplate what he sees. Wow. Says Rav Nassim Vachtvogel, Zatzal, Mashgiach of BMG. The Torah here is pointing out, according to the Svarno, you know what made Moshe great? Something that our generation, maybe more than any that came earlier, is challenged with. And what is that? To be contemplative. To stop and to look and to see unusual things and to think about them. Everyone else, you can just picture the scene. There's a bush burning, not being consumed. There is a supernatural, extraordinary phenomena taking place. And everyone else is walking right by. You know why? Because they're scrolling and they're typing. And it's right here. And they don't even notice it. They don't even see it. They're listening. They're typing. They're scrolling. They're watching. And they don't even see the incredible things happening around them. And Moshe, who's a shepherd, Moshe, who's a thinker, Moshe, who's a meditator, Moshe, who's contemplative, he sees and he says, huh, I got to check that out. What is that? What's going on over there? I want to understand that. I want to think about that. I want to see that. I want to experience that. I want to focus on that. I want to meditate on that. I want to be lost in that. I want to experience that. I want to be present with that. And therefore, Hashem reveals himself. To whom does Hashem reveal himself? Lehizbonin badavar, the people who practice hizboninness. If your mind is so scattered and there's always noise filling your head, if you're never present and mindful, if you're never in the moment, if you're just being carried in the momentum of life, it's going to be very hard to connect with Hashem. Very hard for Him to reveal Himself to you. But when you live a life, lizbonin badavar, we're contemplative, we stop, we see, we think, we feel, we experience, then we're going to see Hashem. We're going to see Hashem. Go for a walk around the lake. And you know what you'll see and hear and feel? The wildlife, the nature, the rustle of the leaves, the ripple of the lake, of the water, the animal life that's walking, the magnificent, go at the right time of the day, you can see the sun that's setting and the different colors in the sky. There's amazing things to see. You just have to do it where you're not looking down while you're walking. Like Moshe, kisar liros, turn to see how, through a commitment, lizbonin badavar, through a commitment to be contemplative in life. Perikim apasik zayin. Hashem tells Moshe why he wants him. Vayomer Hashem ra'ur isi asani ami asasher b'mitzrayim. I see the suffering of my people in Egypt. Ves tzakasam shamati. And I hear their cries, mipnei nogsav. And I hear their cries, excuse me, and I hear their cries because of their taskmasters. Ki yadati es machovav. I know their pain. Yadativ es machovav. Yadati. I know their suffering. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, note the use of the word yadati. What does the word yadati mean? Whenever we use the term da'as in Torah, da'as does not mean, we classically translate the word da'as as knowledge. But that's not what it means. Da'as implies, writes the Rav, more than cognitive awareness, it implies intimacy, closeness of association, sympathy with the other fellow. Hashem saw the Jewish people, he became intimate with their suffering. The term denotes passional knowledge, the eyes, sympathy with the thou. Das implies intimacy, hence, sexual act in Hebrew uses the term das. Go back to Bereshis. Adam yada eschava ishto. Man knew his wife, knew her biblically. It means they were intimate. We don't have a Hebrew word, a biblical word, for a physical sexual act of intimacy. It's called knowledge. Why is it called knowledge? Because the ultimate knowledge you can have of another, the greatest moment of vulnerability, the most exposed you could be, let the other person have access in with you, is knowledge. That's the ultimate knowledge two people can have. What is intimacy? The Jewish, and we could talk about this for hours, the Jewish notion of intimacy is something we share together that's not shared widely or broadly or with others. The more exclusive, the more I allow you in to my emotion, to my thoughts, or have access to my very being, something no one else can, the more intimate we are. But the more what I'm telling you I also posted online, then it doesn't yield a sense of an intimate connection. There's no emotional bond. The more what you get to see, everybody gets to see who walks the street. And what we experienced, I experienced different nights of the week with other people. Then the less intimacy you'll be able to achieve. and what's going on in our time, where there is an enormous decrease in the younger people in physical intimacy. Mind-boggling, right? Because we're living in a time of Sodom and Gomorrah, and yet in actual intimacy, there is a pandemic of challenge of intimacy. And so much of it is a misunderstanding and a distortion of what intimacy is. Intimacy isn't the power of being able to dress however you want and do whatever you want. And emotionally, it's not about being able to just post whatever you feel, whatever you're experiencing, and sharing it with the world. All of that actually destroys intimacy. It takes away any possibility of intimacy. To have emotional intimacy with another, hopefully your spouse, be it a best friend, it means there are things you're willing to share, you let them in, you give them access to, that you don't with others. And that yields a sense of connection, of intimacy. That's knowledge. That's why the Torah word for intimacy is da'as. You now know, you've been in my inner world, my fears, my hopes, my aspirations. You now know. That's why the Torah, Adam yada eschave ishto, says the Rav, that's what's going on over here. Ki adati esmach ovav. I know their pain. Of course you know their pain. You're God. You know everything. You're infinite, omnipotent. Why is Hashem describing, I know you know their pain. Hashem says, no, not I know their pain, because I read it in a report, because I was briefed on it. I know their pain means I feel their pain. I have an intimate connection with their suffering. It's a different level and understanding of Das. Perek Gimel, Pasuk Ches. I'll go down and I'll save them from Egypt, to take them out of that land, to take them to the land flowing with milk and honey, to this precious land. Writes Rabbi Soloveitchik, we'll do one more. God describes, I will go down and save them from where? Miyad. What's the next word? Not a trick question, people. What's the next word? Miyad Mitzrayim. What's the word Mitzrayim? Egypt. Is God saving them from Egypt? No. From whom is God saving them? Miyad Paro or Miyad Mitzrim? From the Egyptians. What does it mean from Egypt? Why is God described, I'm going to go down, liberate them, rescue them, save them, take them out of Egypt? No, you're going to take them away from the Egyptians, says Rabbi Soloveitchik. There are actually two exoduses. One is from the Eretz Mitzrayim, the land of Mitzrayim. The other is from the people of Mitzrayim, from their culture, their ideas, their philosophy, their way of life, their mores. The exodus from Egypt took place on the 15th night of Nisan. It was complete. But the exodus from Mitzrayim is a long process. What took place in one night was only the liberation from the land. But leaving Mitzrayim fully is a long road, which the Jew has been traveling for 3,500 years without yet arriving at his destination. The Messianic redemption is a continuation of the redemption from Egypt. When Moshe received the assignment to appear before Pharaoh, take the Jews out of Egypt, Hashem said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt. I've heard their cries. My purpose is not just to save them from Eretz Mitzrayim. My final goal, the ultimate end, is Miyad Mitzrayim. In other words, taking the Jews out of Egypt, that was the easy part. Taking Egypt out of the Jews, that's much harder. And that he's still working on and we're still working on. Taking the Jews out of Egypt, 10 plagues, splitting of a sea, a few miracles, that's easy for God. Egypt, taking the Jews out of Egypt, easy. Taking Egypt out of the Jews, that's much harder. Moshe had a tough assignment, and Hashem gave him the task of taking the Jews, Me'eretz Mitzrayim, he wouldn't have argued. But when he said, Miyad Mitzrayim, that's much harder. Taking them out of Egypt, I got it, says Moshe. Taking Egypt out of them, I'm not so sure about. That's going to be much tougher, that's going to be much harder. Okay, we'll end with one more. Hashem tells Moshe that these people, they are my eldest child. Perek Dalet Pasuk Chav Beis. Skip, 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 skip. End of the Torah. End of the Parsha. Page 310. You're going to go. You're going to greet Aaron. He's going to be happy for you. V'yamarta al Paro kom Hashem b'ni b'chor Yisrael. Tell Paro, God said, the Jewish people are my eldest son. That's our status. Now, there's a little bit of a contradiction because on the one hand, Banim Atem L'Hashem Elokeichem. On the one hand, it's formulated as if we are God's only children. On the other hand, it's formulated we are God's oldest child. If you have an oldest child, what does that strongly imply? You also have other children. Okay, how do you reconcile that? I'll leave that for you another time. But B'ni B'chor Yisrael, how do you understand what it means to be that we are his oldest child? We're the B'chor. He has other children, but we're his favorite. We're his eldest. We're his number one. So Rashi says, B'ni B'chori Lashon Gedula. Afani B'chor Et Nehu. Quotes a pasuk in Tehillim. And the Medrash. Chasam HaKadosh Baruch HaMachiris HaBechor Shloka Ke'achim Me'esav. The B'chor is the greatest. And Hashem says, you Jewish people, you're my greatest. But the Meshech Chachma, this is from this new Sefer. Shlalo Shal Rabbeinu Meir Simcha. Collecting the different teachings of Meir Simcha. And he says the following. Meshech Chachma says, what does it mean, B'ni B'chori Yisrael? The eldest son gets a double portion. Why? First of all, the oldest son has greatest responsibility. Something happens to the father, the assumption is that the oldest son steps in and takes over in his place. The oldest son was responsible to care for his younger sisters. He needed the resources to do it, to have a dowry to marry them off. So he got a double portion because he needed to be empowered with what was necessary to act as the oldest son. But that's not what the Meshech Chachma says. Meshech Chachma writes, Hatam lakach shum shehu asa oso la'av. Kasher yatza mi beten, imo la'avir ha'olam. By being born, that child made his father a father. That eldest son designated the parents as parents. Until he was born, they were just a married couple. When he was born, they became parents. And therefore, B'ni B'chor Yisrael. That, says the Meshech Chachma, is what God tells Moshe, you go tell Paro. That what? Kein Yisrael. Asu kiviyochel Hashem Yisbarach la'av la'olam. Hashem, creator of the universe. What made him a father? The birth of the Jewish people. When we accepted him, when we came along, he became a father. And if we're the ones who made him a father, then we became his b'chor. That's why we have that status. Pick up next week. Stay happy, stay healthy, and stay holy.